Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Katie Pryle. She is a law professor, an author, and many, many other things that we're going to talk about. And she's also my cousin. So she's probably the person in the law that I have known the longest. I've known her my entire life. So Katie, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're glad to have you here. I know some of our listeners probably know who you are through Twitter, but those that don't, will you just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of your background?
Sure. I am a lawyer and an author and a keynote speaker and a law professor, adjunct now at the University of North Carolina School of Law.
You were an academic as well outside of law.
I was full-time at UNC Law for about 10 years, and then I stepped back to write full-time in 2014, but I still teach there as an adjunct and enjoy it very much.
You got a graduate degree in creative writing, then you went to law school, and then you got a PhD in rhetoric, and you haven't really practiced. You've kind of done the academic side of things. Is that kind of a fair way to put it?
You know, it's funny. I've practiced in the margins. In fact, the thing I forgot to tell you is that, of course, I'm of counsel at Gordon Reese Scully and Mazzucani, which is a, you know, national firm. And so I average like one matter a month with them right now. Sometimes it's more, but it's really a blast to work with them. So I definitely maintain my license and practice law. And when I was getting my PhD, I practiced part-time at a workers' comp firm. So that helped me graduate without debt, which is a really nice thing. So even though we get fellowships when we go into doctoral programs, you know, I had a teaching assistantship. I had roommates and we all squatted in a house together. You still end up this, like, doesn't cover all that, doesn't cover everything you need. And we take out loans, but I was able to work part-time with a really flexible schedule for a workers compensation firm. And so I have practiced law in the margins, let's say, and I maintain my license. I actually have a firm of my own where mostly to help my friends get out of trouble.
Which is an incredibly valuable service. Yes.
They're like, can you write a letter? And I'm like, yeah, I can do
that. Katie's just formalized what we all get as lawyers. Yeah, right?
Exactly. You've probably done it the better way. You also did a federal clerkship, and we can talk about it as much as you want to, but yours kind of had a unique aspect that I'd love for you to share. We talked about it before we started recording.
So I clerked for a federal judge, the chief district judge in the Eastern District of North Carolina at the time. And I was thrilled, of course, because it was such a wonderful clerkship, but the location was really special. It's Elizabeth City, North Carolina, which sits on the Passwatank River, which opens right into one of the sounds on our Outer Banks. Okay. So I was on the inside coastline with the Outer Banks outside. So I could just cross a bridge and be right near Kerala and Duck, if you guys know where that is, or Kitty Hawk. Okay. And so I had to live out there, which was a lot of fun. And there were a variety of interesting things that we got to do because we were in the Eastern District. So our jurisdiction included all the parks, including the National Seashore. So we had cases that were hilarious and also kind of weird because of the National Seashore. And like one involved the wild ponies, you know, one involved, I mean, it was just, you name it. And the sea turtles, like that. Like, and we had some vacancies on the court. So we would go and we would sit in New Bern, which is down the coast. And so we would travel some. And of course, he had chambers in Raleigh. We traveled some. And on one of our trips, he was like, let's just go to the lighthouses. And so the public is allowed to go up the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse, but they're not allowed to go up the others. So we got to go up the one on Ocracoke Island, which I don't recommend because it is very narrow. And in fact, I kind of got claustrophobic and freaked out in that one because I don't know if a human today is supposed to be able to fit inside that lighthouse. And I am 6 feet tall. And I went up in that. And like, as you go, like, it gets smaller, right? And like, I had to be like, and the stairs were so narrow. And I'm ducking down to try to turn my body to fit these spiral stairs that I swear just weren't welded together anymore. And finally I got, and it's not very tall. Like Hatteras is enormous. And I just was like, I don't feel a need to go all the way to the top of this one. And so I came back down. And like, you know, and so this is on Ocracoke, and that's the one where Blackbeard had his, you know, his hideout. And so Ocracoke is an island. You had to take a, you have to take a ferry to get there. And so we ferried over to Ocracoke. And then there's the one Shackleford Banks. That's the, with the diamonds on it. And I can't remember. Ah, this is, I'm like, this is the Body Island, Hatteras, Ocracoke, and the other one. And I cannot remember what it's called. Bad North Carolina girl here. And again, we got to go up that one, which is lovely and not scary. And Hatteras, which is extremely tall. And I am a fit person and yet not fit enough to get all of this. I was like, done. So anyway, that was neat. And the reason we were able to go in, of course, is this is on federal land. And so the park rangers, who all knew my judge and really liked him, respected him a lot, allowed us, you know, and escorted us into these, into this federal land to let us see them. And that was a real treat. So that was nice. And we got to see the ponies, which was also nice.
I just think it's super cool. It's, you know, you think about a federal clerkship and being on the Outer Banks and all the wild animals is not something that you think about. So
no. Oh, we saw sea turtles. It really was neat. It was really cool. So
I'm curious about your practice area and your teaching concentration, both as a lawyer and as a law professor. What are you talking about and practicing?
You know, I did workers' compensation law before and all through grad school. So I got my PhD in rhetoric, and that took approximately like 3.5-4 years to do that. And then, so during that time, I practiced law. And so when I was first brought in to Gordon Reese, it was to do workers' comp, but then I branched out. They're like, oh, you can do employment law? And I said, yeah. And so now mostly I do, I actually haven't had a workers' comp case since that first one. And so I do employment law, mostly like contracts, like non-disclosure and non-compete agreements and things like that. But that was not my area of research as a professor. My area of research was disability law, actually. So if you look at my publications on my CV, which, you know, is boring, but if you chose to do that and because you needed to fight insomnia, you could see my publications and they would, you know, that focus on mostly psychiatric disability, that mental illness, any kind of neurodivergence like that. So that was my main focus. So disability studies is the area. And that's where I published the most. But my other major area of research was legal writing, is continues to be. I actually have a new article coming out. I just placed it and it's coming out in the next book of the Barry Law Review. And then I'm giving a talk at the every other year. So biennial conference of the Legal Writing Institute, which is the scholarly body of legal writing studies. And so I'm looking forward to that. So I keep my hand in academia in that way. So those are my two main areas, disability studies and legal writing. And hilariously, actually, I sometimes am an expert in legal writing issues. So I'll write an affidavit or a declaration for something in litigation. People just find me. And so like, is this comma mean what we think it means, or test that these parentheses don't change the meaning of this sentence? And I have done that all over the country.
Wow.
I have never heard of this. You get to do that? People hire you to pick apart their writing?
Yeah, mostly it's really dumb stuff. Like, it's like somebody is trying desperately to win their argument and they're doing it on something that's very specious. And yet someone else is like, I still need to submit something. Can you please just say that this is dumb? And I'm like, I can't say it like that, but I can say I'll say it in a way that it gets to the point. Yeah. So grammar expert.
And one of the things that you've published is the Complete Legal Writer series with Alexa Chu. We don't have to talk too much about it, but I love it because it introduces the idea of teaching through genres. If you want to talk about that a little bit, I just think that's kind of a cool approach.
Right. So in fact, the new article is called Genre Discovery 2.0, which is coming out, like I said, in a year. It's an editorial. So the first article was Genre Discovery. This is my own article again. I can't remember the title. Teaching Law Students How to Write Any Document or something like that was the subtitle. Really big, bold claim, which is how we should title things, I think. Just go big. And so I wrote this article back in like, well, 10 years ago. That's why the new one's coming out. So 2012 or something, 2013. And in it, I brought, this is my rhetoric and composition PhD, this idea of using genres to teach legal writing. And what that means is that you don't teach people to write a particular office memo or a particular appellate brief. You teach them that appellate briefs are a genre, which means a document type, okay, that exists beyond the one that they're writing. It existed before the one they're writing and it will exist after. And so that means it's a recurring document type. And if it recurs, that means it has conventions that we follow when we write them. And that's how we know how to identify them. So if you put five appellate briefs on the table in front of you guys, right, you would know, or how about four appellate briefs and one office memo, you could pick out which one was not the appellate brief. And the reason why we're able to do that is because genres exist. Okay. So like, which one's the office memo? Well, that one, because, you know, it's not an appellate brief. These are. That doesn't mean that all appellate briefs are exactly the same. It means that they share conventions, which are not rules, not a template, okay, but conventions. And if you can learn the conventions, then you can write an appellate brief in different situations. Well, this jurisdiction has different rules. Well, that's fine. So you can learn those rules. You can learn those conventions because you know how to learn them. So what we teach in The Complete Legal Writer, and what I suggested in this original article, and Alexa definitely helped me transform into something that's teachable, is how to teach students how to teach themselves genres they've never encountered before. So when they go into a summer internship or into practice and someone says, okay, now you need to write a bankruptcy brief. And they're like, I didn't learn that in law school. That's fine. So you go and you get five samples out of your firm's files and you lay them out in front of you and you study the conventions, their similarities. What do they have in common? And then you can figure out what the conventions are just if you have this skill of discovering a genre, that's genre discovery. So then no genre is new to you, undiscoverable to you. You can discover anything. So that's the idea, is empowering students to teach themselves.
I love it because it's something that I think all of us have done at some point, you know, certainly if you're at a firm, you get on the system and you search for whatever it is and, you know, but it really formalizes it and gives it a name rather than just looking around on the system blindly.
That's right. That's exactly right. We already use GoBys. And so instead of just sort of hacking it together, I said, okay, we use GoBys. We do this. Well, what do we do exactly? Let me analyze this and put it into practical terms. Okay. Find some samples, okay, then sit down and look for these things, okay, and then you take this, okay, and right, so the thing that we sort of teach ourselves, fumble through, right, in their first year or two of practice, now the students enter practice already able to do this. They're like, hello, I need some go-bys, and I need her to have three, thank you, and ideally in front of the same judge. And then they come and get, and they know exactly what to ask for, you know, exactly what to look for, so many fewer hours billed. I mean, this is a real skill, so.
No, I love that label because I think it's just so accurately describes what we do when we are trying to teach ourselves. Even as lawyers, you get new assignments. You're into an area that you're not familiar with necessarily. And 25 years of practice, you're still looking for a form or a template or a go-by. Mm-hmm. And I just really like that name of, you know, sort of framing it into the genres. It's cool.
So yeah, so The Complete Legal Writer is the first book in a series. Joni might know this already. And so it's called The Complete Series for Legal Writers. And so that genre discovery is pulled through all of the books. And so the second one is The Complete Bar Writer, which is focused on the MPT, the Multi-State Performance Test. I'm not sure if it wasn't a test part of the test when I took it. And that's the one where students are given a case file and they have to write some sort of genre, right? And so we wrote this book with the idea of genre discovery. What if you're given something and you don't know what it is? And so how do you discover what the genre is and how to write it? So we brought it through to that book. And then the third book is coming out in a month. And it's The Complete Pre-Law Writer, which is targeted towards students entering law school, like in summer programs, undergrads, but also like paralegals and others who are lawyer adjacent. And it's a condensed version with assignments that are more, instead of like all the entire litigation process, like in The Complete Legal Writer, it's just six writing assignments. So yeah, so the genre discovery thing is definitely the thread that connects the whole complete series.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Another thing that you do is fiction writing and fiction publishing, which is, if you think about the technical requirements of legal writing, seems a world away, but are they different or do they can they influence each other in a good way?
Oh, gosh. Funny. So I write law textbooks. I write trade nonfiction, which is nonfiction like you'd find in Barnes & Noble trade books, right? So as opposed to academic books. And then I also write novels. And so I kind of view them on the spectrum of like the novels are way over here on the one side of, and then the textbooks are way on the other side of the spectrum and the trade nonfiction's in the middle. You know, there's footnotes in those. So they're sort of in the middle. But I recently actually came to the idea that actually I went about that all wrong. And I put them all on a list by year. I just made this table. I was like, Katie, what have you published every year since like you started writing books and how they're grouped together? And so like, what have I written and when? And it was a very enlightening experience because what I found was, is that I do like a novel and then a textbook and then a trade nonfiction book and then a novel and then a textbook and then a trade nonfiction book. It's like, I think that with that, there's a reason that my brain wants to spread around like that. I don't know. Other people, everybody's different, right? They are very different types of writing and I enjoy them all. And they each feed my soul in a different way or allow me to share my thoughts with the world in a different way. And I want to do them all. And I want to do them all at the same time, which is, it's my job. So that I feel very lucky. So it's, you don't want to, I don't know about your practice areas, but doing the exact same thing every day, it would be very boring. And so I feel that way. And so if you look at each year, it's like, okay, a textbook. And then like there was a novel and then there's maybe a trade nonfiction and maybe a textbook. And then, and it's like that. And I didn't think about it. It just how the work came around.
Are there conventions and ideas from writing fiction that you think adapt particularly well to legal writing?
Well, the first thing that I learned about writing a long piece of any sustained piece of work, I learned from a friend of mine who's a novelist right after I finished my master's in creative writing. And he said, books are about structure, period. Okay. Short stories, whatever, poetry, whatever. He's like, I don't know about this, but when you write a book, it's about structure and then everything else follows from there. And I don't know if everybody would agree with him, but it made perfect sense to me. And so when I sit down to plan any book that I write, I start with the structure. What is the arc, or we can think about the architecture. What is the architecture of this novel? Okay. Or this law review article or this appellate brief that I might write. I wrote a trial brief recently. And I, you start with this sort of big picture view of the main arguments and like, where does the law fall, right? Structure. And so I don't write really rigorous or strict outlines of my novels. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there has to be a beginning and some sort of end that you're aiming towards and a structure as you go, but things that have to happen in order for the story to hold together. Otherwise you have a meandering mess, but that goes for everything that you write, right? You don't want a meandering mess. You don't turn that into a judge. You don't want to turn that in to it. You don't want your textbook to be a meandering mess. And so people think, oh, well, in a novel, you don't, no, my novels are tightly, and the best ones are like very, that gesturing with my hands, they are fine tuned as far as structure goes. It wasn't COVID, so my memory worked, but it was either John Updike or Mark Twain, not the same guy. One of them said that the ending of a story should be both unexpected and surprising and totally expected. So in other words, you have to set it up in such a way that it's not predictable, but also the most obvious way it had to go. So, which is extremely difficult tightrope to walk, if you think about it.
One of the things that I think is interesting about your career is that you sort of made the decision along there to go freelance. I think both in terms of your publishing and in academia and all that. How did that come to be? I mean, how did you make that decision? Because I feel like even in the strictures of legal practice, there's probably a lot of people who would love to kind of find that way out of those barriers.
So I've meant to be very honest about money when it comes to being a writer, because a lot of it is shrouded in secrecy and I don't like that at all. I was able to leave academia full time because one of my textbooks started making enough money for me to do so. So, and because I have a spouse who has healthcare. So I was employed by UNC and we were on my medical plan, which is the state health plan, but we were able to join my husband's health plan. So we had healthcare and the income from one of my books, it just took off. And so I was able to leave higher ed, concentrate on writing full time. And that is, you could consider that luck. I do. So I also think that I did work very hard. I wrote 3 books in like 3 years. So I was really, and this is when I had 2 kids in less than 2 years, and I wrote 3 books in that span of time. And so that, you know, and it was one of those books that took off. And then, so my kids were born in 09 and 11. And then my first book came out in 10. And then 11 was the next book. And then I guess the next one didn't come. It was like, came out in 14. It was like January 14. So, but then that was it. I was able to leave in 14. I feel very lucky that I had this. It's like the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule. Mm-hmm. Like 80% of my income is this one title and 20% of my writing income. And then 20% are all my other books. And so, but if you ask authors who do make a living from their books, that's the way it is. One, you have one book that hits and then you write and write and write and write and write. And maybe in another 15 years, you have another one. And so it's just how it is. The rest of it is very workaday grinding out, and except I love it. So I'm not actually complaining about the grind.
Well, one of the other things that I wanted to talk about that I think kind of threads a lot of this stuff is discussion of mental health and disability. It's something that you're very outspoken on and something that you know more about than just about anyone that I know, and kind of how it plays into both law and academia, because I don't think that they're very different approaches.
Yes. Yes, indeed. In fact, my second best-selling book is my book on mental health in higher ed. So Life of the Mind Interrupted, Essays on Mental Health and Disability in Higher Education. And I did get that title right. That one came out in 2017 and is selling more now than it did when it first came out, which is probably a sign of the times. And I have another one I just finished that is with a press at the moment. Fingers crossed that it passes review. And it's Darkness Interrupted. It's like a sequel and is very much a book of the now, but is also about mental health in crisis situations. Because I went to law school, I started in 2000. So my second year was 9/11. And so we had people who, psychologists who study these things called it, we had a shock event, a population shock event occur. And then the aftermath of that was the change in how we travel, the TSA, Homeland Security, all these big changes in our society, and the war on terror and the terror alert colors. It was 20 years ago. It seems like, but if you think about it, we were all a little on edge, okay? And of course, if you lived in the New York area, you were on edge a lot. And so I went to visit a friend of mine, and he said every time a siren went off for years, he'd, you know, jump out of bed and freak out. Like he couldn't help it. And that, and he didn't work downtown. You know, it just didn't matter. So it was like a, you know, citywide, you know, post-traumatic situation, and that's normal. And so we're living in this extended shock event, worldwide population shock event. And so this book is about population shocks, including COVID. And it is also a book on higher ed, but the content about how to deal with this, how it affects burnout, for example, how it affects just your day-to-day life, all these things, you know, extend way past higher education. Higher education happens to be my very special area of expertise. And so it's, you know, COVID has caused us, the subtitle is Reckoning with Mental Health and Higher Education Now, right? And it's caused us to have a reckoning with mental health in a new way. I think people who might not have spoken about mental health before COVID are really, really willing to talk about it now, mm-hmm. which is a good thing, mm-hmm. even though I wish people weren't suffering. Of course, I'm glad that we're able to have these conversations.
It's such a pervasive problem in the law and always has been. And it's something that the law has been particularly slow to catch up to, because I think to your point, I really have seen it come out a lot more in the last 2 or 3 years, probably more than, you know, the previous 15 years before that when I was a law student and a lawyer, because you just didn't talk about it because there were worries about getting into law school, getting able to take the bar, passing character and fitness and all of those things, which discourage people both, I think, from seeking treatment and talking about it.
Correct.
In ways that were particularly harmful, although maybe not intended to be that way.
You know, I wrote a piece for Slate years ago. Gosh, I don't remember when it was. And the title was The Worst Part of the Bar Exam, which was not a title I would have picked because we're lawyers, so we hedge. The worst, I don't know, something bad about the bar exam, right? But that doesn't get clicks. So the title is called The Worst Part of the Bar Exam. It's for Slate. I co-authored it with another law professor. And we talked about the character and fitness and mental health. And so it's this invisible barrier that no one knows about unless it affects them. And then it's horrible because you, at least in North Carolina, I had to do this. I filled it out. And then I wouldn't know if I passed the character and fitness until after I passed the bar or took the bar.
Really?
They didn't let us know. So you take the bar exam, do the best you can. And then maybe you pass the actual test, but then later they're like, but actually no. And so that was like, you're in January filling this out or something. And when I got to those questions, which I did not know were coming, another problem, we need to tell everybody, there needs to be a worldwide announcement in law school at the beginning of, you know, you're going to be asked these questions. We are going to help you with them. This person is an expert in this area and this person will help you with them. That wasn't, of course, there. And I got to those questions, I just started sobbing because do you have these diagnoses? One of them was mine. And then if you do, sign this blanket release so we can get all your medical records. That was the deal. And I was like, I really don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. Feel super invasive and also made me feel like the members of my state bar did not want me to be a lawyer, did not want to welcome me into their ranks. And the more I've worked on this area, I think that's probably what set me on the path of disability studies was that experience. And I gave a talk at George Washington University years ago. Everything's years ago now.
that's exactly right.
Okay.
Pre-COVID is years ago.
Years ago, I gave a talk about this very subject at George Washington about disability, psychiatric disability, and the legal profession and how and the gatekeeping and that sort of thing. And I pulled the character and fitness questions from various states and put them up there just to see. And there has been a movement to get rid of those questions. But what I talked about was how what this does is not, you know, protect the profession by any means, because what you're keeping out are the people who have sought treatment. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you're encouraging people to not seek treatment so they don't have to answer yes. Have you ever sought help from a mental health professional? You get to say no if you didn't. And that's not good. Like you mentioned this yourself. And we need to be encouraging, you know, the statistics on law students and depression are depressing. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
I think we're at 40% right now by the time they graduate. And then lawyers themselves, like we're the most depressed group of people on the planet.
It's staggering, the numbers.
Yes. And so, right. So the second main group of people that I give talks to about mental health are lawyers. I give at least one talk a year to a group of lawyers about mental health. And you know, we're not doing well. And we never really have been doing well. And there are things that we could do better to fix that problem. But it requires an institutional level will.
Well, it does. And it dovetails into, I think, the giant numbers that relate to substance abuse in practicing attorneys very much so. I love that you apply the disability lens to it, because I don't think that's necessarily an intuitive thing for lawyers to think about. Can you kind of talk about disability and what really falls under that umbrella? Because I think it might surprise people.
Correct. So term psychiatric disability is not something a lot of people have heard. Okay. So we think of disability, we think of wheelchairs, like that is like the thing people think. Okay, people who use wheelchairs, fine. But psychiatric disability is what we might call mental illness, but it can be broader than that. But you can have a mental illness and not be currently mentally ill, right? Okay, so I have bipolar disorder. I am autistic, okay? I am disabled, okay? Right now, as I speak to you, I am a person with disabilities. I am disabled. I could apply for accommodations if I needed to at a job. Okay. So that's what disabled means, right? So, and I can get more into the, you know, the life activities and things like that. But I have disabilities that are recognized by Social Security Administration, that sort of thing. Now, stepping back from that, if you have suicidal depression, okay, or really bad anxiety, it's so bad that you can barely get out of bed, you have a mental illness. You might have not had that your whole life. And then one day you suddenly have developed major depression. It happens. This story I tell often is William Styron, who wrote the book Darkness Visible. I poached his title for my new book. And it came out in 1990. And in it, this is the author who wrote Sophie's Choice. People know that it was a movie. And he writes this book at the age of 60, suddenly for the first time in his life, just hammered by suicidal depression. And he tells a very good story. It's a short book. It's like 90 pages of what it felt like. And it's amazing actually how just precise he's like, this is what it was like. And I couldn't remember where my hotel room was, like, cause there's this amnesia thing that can happen. And I'd forgotten this thing. And he'd gotten an award. He couldn't remember where to go. You know, it was all these, and he's so depressed. He just wanted to die. So up until he was 60, he did not have depression. And then after 60, he is a person who had depression until the day he died. And that's it. It doesn't just go away. And so he became psychiatrically disabled at the age of 60. Okay. So then, you know, it can come from nowhere. It can come from a situation that might happen. Someone might be, you know, have postpartum depression. Then depression becomes something that a person might battle with forever. Or an event might happen. I don't know, a huge population shock event might happen and create an anxiety. So you know, our anxiety disorder diagnoses in this country are up 25% or so, according to The Lancet. So this is like not just big deal, right? And so anxiety disorder is a psychiatric disability. Here's the thing though, people don't like to think of themselves as disabled. That is not something that a lot of people want to identify with. So I often say people who identify as disabled. So I will say that when I talk about these things with people, because the word disabled will make people go, oh, I don't want to be that. And then they might reject the idea of seeking help or something like that. For other people, being able to identify as disabled brings them into a community of people who are also disabled. And there's a very strong disability community. So that's another reason to do so. There's benefits. But I am careful to, when I use these terms, I'm careful to explain what they mean and that it's okay if identifying as disabled is not something that you want to do, but it's important still to recognize if you have anxiety disorder or depression, or if you feel like you're falling into burnout, which although is not an official diagnosis, is something that psychologists recognize and can lead very quickly to other things that are more serious, that you should definitely seek treatment for those things.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
You touched on burnout, and I do want to go there a little bit because I know it's something you've talked and written on a lot recently, and it's something that I feel like everyone has had a touch of in the last few years, whether it's been severe or not. And, you know, particularly in the legal profession over the years, it's always been a problem, but I feel like it's just become exacerbated.
Yep. So yesterday I gave a talk on burnout to a bunch of lawyers, which it was nice to talk to lawyers about this because I felt like you said, we struggle with burnout as a profession more than others do. And one of the things I said was it's a lot easier to recognize burnout among your employees and help them through that than it is to lose your employee and have to start all over again with a new one. So how can we prevent that from happening? The talk itself was on what I call systemic burnout. And this is, I think, an important thing to think about right now is that because of the population shock we've experienced with COVID, that the burnout is related to that it is systemic. Okay. So if a population shock is an unexpected negative event that disrupts a large population, okay, it doesn't have to be worldwide. We happen to be in like this worldwide one, but it can be 9/11. It can be a school shooting in a town. That's still, right? So Parkland, right? That's a population shock in a city, okay? And these population shocks increase the prevalence of anxiety and depression, okay? That research, that's the Lancet article I referred to, this increase in anxiety and depression. If listeners are interested, I can give a citation to that article. Okay, and so I'm arguing in my research is that these population shocks lead to burnout, yes, but it's a systemic burnout. So if burnout is stress compounded over a prolonged period, and then suddenly we fall into burnout, then systemic burnout is widespread, okay, among a large population caused by these large scale shock events. But this is the hard part, is that it's difficult to spot systemic burnout because it is so prevalent. So if everybody's walking around in a stupor, then it seems like that stupor is normal. And that's what makes it so hard to deal with, to even identify systemic burnout when it's happening. Well, everybody feels this way. Everybody feels terrible. You know, I'm not special. We're all in the same boat. All these things we say to ourselves to make ourselves feel like nothing's wrong. You know, we're lying to ourselves. We're tricking ourselves. We're gaslighting ourselves. Okay. And, you know, if we're all in the same boat, that boat is sinking. Okay. So in fact, around 40% of people right now, workers identified as being burned out, but only about 35% said they were doing anything about it. And so I'm like, come on. Okay. So what are we going to do? So the problem is that the solution to systemic burnout is we keep putting the burden on the individual to fix it. Oh, do yoga, self-care, you know, all these things. And I'm like, no, it's a systemic problem. So it needs large scale. And in fact, so it's not, by the way, I want to distinguish it between institutional, which you could argue like the legal profession has institutional burnout problem. Okay. And that is, I do believe also is true. So that's within an institution that's created by institutional culture. Okay. And so in fact, so we have a double whammy happening. We have this systemic burnout with COVID, and then we have an institutional culture in the legal profession that also can lead to burnout depending on your workplace, of course, and your supervisor and the demands of your job. But I think that we can agree that as an institution, the legal profession has this burnout problem. I think we've all sort of established that, right? And then burnout, although not a recognized diagnosis, is we do know it leads to anxiety, depression, people leaving their jobs. And of course, the main thing you see is this detachment, this cynicism, this lack of caring, right? So, you know, if you're still feeling stressed out and frazzled and all these things and worried that you're not getting your work done, you're not burned out yet. You still care. Oh my God, I missed a deadline. I'm so upset, right? You still care, right? It's when you stop caring that you missed a deadline, when, you know, your inbox is full and you're like, oh, how am I going to answer all these? No, that's when you really need to worry. Well, you need to worry before that. You should head it off, right?
Yeah.
Right. So you're burned out if you're detached, okay? And you feel like nothing I do matters. It's the who cares? It doesn't even matter that I'm here. I make no difference. Okay. Those thoughts. Okay. That's burnout. That's a red alert. Okay. So how do you prevent that? Is when you are feeling frazzled, stressed, overworked, that nothing you do can get you back to like, you're at like negative 10. You just want to be at zero. Okay. Let alone like in the, like you're in the red. You just want to, you're never going to be in the black, right? This is how many of us feel. We're trying to just catch up or stay afloat or pick a metaphor. That is when you intervene. And so now you're going to say, how, Katie, how do we intervene? And so I have some answers.
That's what I want to know. Okay. So, give us the practical tools. Come on.
There's the employer side of things and the employee side of things, and they're different. And so if you're an employee, again, so well, all workers, right? So we're all workers, whether we're supervisors or not. We're looking for missed deadlines. Okay. So we're spotting it. So again, systemic burnout, harder to see. Institutional burnout, also harder to see. So this is the double whammy that the legal profession faces. So missed deadlines, okay, but even more than usual. This person's always a little late, but now they're really late, okay? Or a person who never misses deadlines, and now they're missing them, okay? Deadlines. Work events or personal events, doesn't matter, okay, that you keep forgetting. Now, this idea, this joke I was making, I can't remember if this is Twain or Updike, and I can't even remember the quote. It's something I used to be able to recall like this. So this is this COVID like amnesia or something that's happening. Fine. Okay. But I'm talking about, I was supposed to turn in a major assignment yesterday and I completely forgot about it. Not missed the deadline. I was unaware. It fell out of my head completely. Or there was our regular Thursday social, right? And I just forgot it was Thursday and forgot the social. I didn't go. Okay, that's being overwhelmed and forgetting things. And then there's the didn't want to attend the social, right? That's the detachment, right? So got to pay attention to the difference here. Your email inbox is full, right? And you can't get through it or you don't want to get through it. Overwhelmed, detached, okay? Notice those things. If you're a supervisor and you have an employee who's not responding quickly enough to your emails, in your opinion, maybe instead of getting angry, ask them how they're doing. Miss deadlines, ask them how they're doing, that sort of thing. If you are a person who is not objectively not a failure, but you feel like you are, then you need to get help right away. Okay. So for example, the three of us are objectively not failures. Okay. But this idea that you feel like a failure, sometimes it can take one tiny thing going wrong. It's just the stupidest, smallest thing. Okay. I'm not talking about losing a big case, even losing a case. Guess what? We get to do that. We get to lose sometimes, you know, and we still are not failures. We just, sometimes the judge woke up on the wrong side of bed or had a bad sandwich. Okay. And that just happens. I mean, you feel like nothing you do matters and you are a failure. Okay. Red alert. Okay. So if you're a supervisor and you can see that someone who used to have that pep in their step doesn't anymore, you need to ask. And so part of this is on the worker's part, noticing that you're overwhelmed before you are burned out. If it's too late, you're already burned out, doing something about that too. Okay. So if you are a supervisor, right, you need to look towards the cause and not towards the individual. Okay. So it's very rare with burnout that it's a person's individual actions that caused it, especially right now. This is a social problem, right? It's systemic. And so it requires structural solutions. For example, workplace solutions. We are in the legal profession, which already has structural problems. So here we go. Like, what can we do? So the first thing is that we need to lower our workplace expectations. And this is really hard right now because we're all finally getting back to work. And so what happens is that the opposite thing is happening than what should be happening, is that all those cases that are backlogged and, you know, the calendars that got backlogged at court and like all these things. And so instead of lowering expectations, they're getting higher. And so that's the reverse of what needs to be happening right now, because we're already at our ends of our ropes. And so, people who have the power to do this need to figure out a way to lower expectations. And that requires recognizing we are nowhere back to normal. This just not, we're not. Even if we go into the office and we put on our suits and we sit around and, you know, and look at each other face to face, we just aren't back to normal yet. The other thing is to check-ins, I keep mentioning. Just check in. Don't wait till they keep missing emails. Check in before that and make it normal for this to happen. These burnout check-ins, you can call them whatever you want, and make it safe. So you have to earn the trust of your employees in order for this to work. So you got to do it a lot. The first time they're going to say, I'm fine, everything's fine, because what else would they say? We're all scared. And so, but maybe by the fourth time you ask, they might start to answer honestly. Actually, I feel like if I have to work this weekend, I'm going to fall to pieces, which is what you need to hear. You really need someone to tell you that truth, because you do not want your employee to fall to pieces, because then you have real trouble. Like, that's where the missed deadlines, filing deadlines, things like that. And to that point, I would suggest you put safeties in place, especially law firms where things like missed deadlines can really matter. You know, this mental load we're carrying is so high that failures are going to occur. They're bound to happen. Okay. Balls will get dropped. And so prevent them. Put people in teams, have people review other people's work. I do this myself. There's another employment lawyer in my office here. Just the other day, I went through something. It seemed obvious, very obvious, this contract, but I just called him on the phone. One billable minute, you know, and I said, I just want to double check this with you. Make sure I didn't miss something really dumb, because that's where we are right now. Because we have this heavy load on our brains, like half our brains is given over to, did I send my kid with a mask? You know, then we don't have that brain space to think about everything we used to think about. So we need these safeties. You can pair people up on projects that we used to do individually. They can have the same number of projects. They just do them together and catch each other. For example, and this is a very basic kind of suggestion. But whatever the safeties might be, put them in place. Have someone double check. Know, expect the failures to occur. That, and be okay with that. I know it's hard to accept the fact that that's the reality we are in, but it is. And for workers, asking for what you need is really important. How to do that, that's harder. What I've found through my research is that the more specific you are, the better this goes. Is instead of saying, this job is burning me out, that's not good. Don't do that. Because what your what your supervisor is going to hear is, I hate my job. And that is most likely not the case. But you wouldn't be talking to them if you hated your job. You would have quit. Okay. And so what you're going to them for is help. And so be specific. I've worked every weekend this month. I'm feeling like I'm at the end of my rope. Can I please have this weekend off to catch up and catch my breath or something? Be very specific with your ask. This weekend off, or this project in particular is causing me some problems or whatever. Can I switch places with this person or take on a different project and hand this one off to someone else? And that the more specific the ask, the better. Other thing to keep in mind if you're a worker talking to a supervisor is that your supervisor is also drowning. They're not just because they're your supervisor doing great. They're also having a hard time. So you need to be sympathetic to them as much as you want them to be sympathetic to you. And lastly, in this conversation, if you're the supervisor, you can open up a bit and be lead from the front by sharing that you are also feeling the pressure and say, I know how you feel. I know I also worked the last 4 weekends, not in a way to say I worked the last 4 weekends. So why can't you? Not that, that's terrible. Don't do that. But say, you know, I've worked a lot of weekends too. I understand how hard that can be. And I also feel this pressure and I'm so sorry that you feel this way and absolutely take the weekend off. And then if you open up and reveal your own suffering to your employee and you create that bond, they're going to come back to you and share with you when they're in trouble because you just led from the front. That's all I got on that.
No, that's good. We've talked before here on our show about the pressure in the legal profession to appear bulletproof and how, you know, just as the culture of our profession, you know, you can use the word toxic, I suppose, and it wouldn't really be.
That's not overstating it.
It's not overstating it. I think, you know, we've observed, Jody and I had the pleasure of starting this whole project in the pandemic. And over the course of the last 2 years, almost, we've seen some change. I mean, we've seen people are more willing to talk about it. Mm-hmm. They're more willing to talk about mental health issues. They're more willing to talk about stress and self-care and all of that. And it's good to have some practical advice on not only what the employer can do in the situation, but I know you said, Katie, that so much of it gets shoved down to the individual, but I think it sort of starts on the individual level. I mean, you have to have that realization of, okay, I'm not okay.
That's right.
And so there is something that the individual can do, but you make the point that if the employer side of this doesn't really pay attention, you have, you know, not only are you losing a ton of productivity in the workplace, but then you have to deal with turnover, which creates additional expense. Mm-hmm. And I think the firms and the companies that are out in front of this are going to be so much better off in the long run because they're going to recover better and faster. And their people are going to, I think, feel appreciated and valued more. So I guess what I'm saying is that it all kind of comes down to culture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, does your culture value you individually? And value your contribution? And does your workplace culture value your contribution to what the overall firm or business is? And we're seeing this whole mass exodus in the employment world. And, you know, maybe it takes a systemic event like this to make us change. I know it has in terms of law practice, but I think we're seeing, you know, the effects on a much broader scale in society. And so, you know, thanks for coming and talking to us about burnout. I don't usually go on a long rant like that.
Okay. You know, it's good.
But we do pay attention. I mean, Jody and I pay attention. We try to be in tune and sort of educate to the extent we can our listeners because we're all people and we need to stay in touch with that side of ourselves, or we're going to be doing something else for a job because we're not going to be practicing law if we're not careful.
Right.
Well, and to your point, I think earlier, there is really power in acknowledging a population shock. I mean, obviously, we're going to continue to see the effects of this, unfortunately, for many years as they kind of bubble to the surface. And so I think it's the more we can talk about it earlier, the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things I say is that the way things were, like, let's get back to the way things were, is the wrong mindset.
Mm-hmm.
We can't. We can't move backwards, and things, we've changed. Our society has changed. And just shift your thinking to how can we move forward the best way we can? And so if instead of thinking about getting back, think about moving. And that is actually a really big mindset shift if you start to think about it from a practical level.
Yeah, I've heard it said, you know, going through, you don't go back, you don't go around. Sometimes you just have to go through. And that seems like that's where we are.
Right. Like, if you see yourself, like, where are we in 2 years? Well, part of it is that we don't know. And part of it is that, and by the way, that accepting, that being learning to accept the unknown is part of the reason we are changed. We're just sort of, we don't know if school will get canceled next week. We don't know if someone will be out with a COVID infection. We don't know if, like, there'll be a judge substitution because of same reason. We don't know. We just don't know. There's a lot of unpredictability, which is another reason there's stress. But in many ways, if we can work through that stress, and we can build an amazing amount of resiliency because we've become accustomed to, if we can, one way to move forward is to become accustomed and our strength in accepting that unknown, and to be able to shift gears and work on the fly. I'd love to have that skill. So that's my burnout rant. And so I really appreciate you guys letting me go on that. That was nice.
No, it's fabulous.
No, we definitely wanted to give you the forum to talk about that. And that's something that we in our profession and our audience need to hear, and, you know, to feel validated about it. You know, from a leadership perspective in a law firm or an organization, you sort of suggested this earlier, but this is an area where it's okay to be a little vulnerable with your people, because that's what it's going to take, really, for us to go through this instead of around or over or backwards, is, you know, the connections that you make in the workplace coming from a leadership perspective. I think it's just going to strengthen the culture in a firm or in an office where you've got leadership that's willing to kind of put themselves out there on a level like this. I mean, you don't have to lay your whole soul bare, and you don't have to go over your own mental health history and be that forthright about everything. But it's just, even something as simple as, you know, and you have to be careful with the "I know how you feel" language, right? But even something as simple as just listening.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a lost art. Hope people are getting back to that now, because it's crucial, I think, for where we are. Well, I'm going to get off my soapbox.
It was such a good one.
It was, absolutely.
It's a topic I care about. And so, but thank you for that. And we're definitely at the end of our time that we had planned to spend together, Katie. But one thing that we like to do is ask our guests for a tip or a war story to sort of cap off the discussion. Did you have something that you'd like to visit with us about?
Sure. I have both in one. So my judge, rather, required his clerks to take the bar exam. So some people put it off till after their clerkship. I had to take it. And so, as you recall, I had to fill out that character and fitness form and cry to my mental health provider to write the mental health record. It was a disaster. All spring, I was freaking out about it. And then by the time it came to take Barbary, I was just depressed. That's all there is to it. I was absolutely detached. I could not get my brain into it at all. I mean, I don't know why I thought I would pass the bar exam, but in the end, I did not pass the bar exam the first time I took it. I missed by less than 1%, which was really great. No, it's terrible. I was like, oh my God. And so I think it was out of 350 points and I had 348 like that. I had that score and I went, so now I have to go tell a federal judge that his clerk has failed the bar exam. And I was terrified. And so I walked into his office with his giant desk, and he's got no computer or anything on it because he's a judge. And so I walk in, he's sitting behind it, and I'm like, so I failed the bar. And I sort of showed him my thing, and he sees that I only failed by what is 2 points, 350? I don't even know what that, it's like whatever less than 1% is. I was like ready for him to be very angry at me. And he had the opposite reaction. He's like, this is preposterous. And he reaches for his phone. He's like, I'm going to call so-and-so. Starts rattling off names who are on the board of law examiners for the state of North Carolina. And I was like, oh, no, don't do that. No, no, stop, wait. Like, straighten this problem out. And I'm like, oh, no, 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 don't do that. And then I'll pass it next time. It's just like, thank you, but no. And it was the most adorable, like, loving, actually felt very loving. Like, he was so up in arms that I had failed the bar exam instead of blaming me. Like, this has to be a mistake. I can correct it. And so, no, it wasn't that. It was not a mistake. I actually did fail the bar. And that is what had, one of the things that compelled me to work on the character and fitness stuff later, was because it's the line, the connection between that failure on the bar exam and my encountering of the character and fitness, like blindsided by the character and fitness earlier. It's just a direct correlation there. The next year, when I knew exactly what was coming and had all the paperwork in order and filed it and took Barbary, and I was all peppy about it and played tennis every day to stay in shape and was like super positive and passed with flying colors. And so, you know, it just was. So the tip is, if you to know about the character and fitness stuff, if you're a law student, if you are someone who is in a position to help a law student, make sure they know to check what their jurisdictions rules are for mental health. Okay. If they require disclosure, do not let them be blindsided by this. This is not okay. It was not okay to find this out as a 3L in the spring of my 3L year. It took a long time. It took me a year to get over it. Okay. And, you know, I was in the top of my class. I had a federal clerkship, and then I failed a bar. My law school was like, what's going on with it? Like, they keep track of these bar passage stats, right? And like, they wanted to talk to me about why. A professor went with me to look at my scores, like what happened. And I'm like, I couldn't articulate it at the time, but you know, by the next year in retrospect, my mental health was in an entirely different place. And it was because by then I was like, I absolutely deserve to be a member of the bar of, you know, State Bar of North Carolina. But a year before, I did not feel that way. So telling the judge that you failed the bar did not come out the way I thought it would. And I was really happy about that. And the tip is, you know, look out for the law students.
That's a really good one. Thanks for telling that story, because I know there are folks out there that need that encouragement on a number of levels. So, Katie, thanks for spending the time with us today. We really enjoyed visiting with you.
Well, it's so nice to meet you, Todd. Jody, always nice to see you.
Of course.
Okay. And I really appreciate the time to talk about things that I feel really passionate about. So thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.